Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 847. My name is Camden Busey, and I'm in Libertyville, Illinois. Excited to be with some brothers and looking forward to talking about Reformed theology and diving back into some Reformation church history, obviously because we're interested in that, but also because there's a great benefit and instruction for us as we're diving into a really interesting subject. Let me introduce to you first. We have with us someone who is no stranger to Reformed Forum. We have Dan Ragusa, who's a pastor at Messiah Reformed Fellowship, URC congregation in Manhattan, there in New York. Welcome back, Dan. It's good to see you today.
Thanks, Camden. Good to see you and good to be back on here.
Wonderful. Yeah, we're excited to have you. Of course, Dan has taught a course for us at Reformed Academy, looking at 2 Peter, and we've got a matching course with Kevin Sherrod on 1 Peter, but hopefully we'll have Dan back sooner rather than later to talk more. So if you're interested in following up with some of Dan's resources, and you can check him out at reformedforum.org. We also have a book coming up. Dan, your little booklet's in the works. I got to check in with Peg to see where it's at, but Fullness of Joy should be coming out soon. Any word? Maybe you know more about this than I do, do you?
No, I don't know anything. I think I picked a cover design and that was about it. But yeah, a small little book tracing the God with us theme throughout the scriptures. So yeah, looking forward to that coming out.
It's on its way. Lots of good stuff coming out this year. And I know Dan's got some other manuscripts and other things we're looking at. We got to follow up and we'll have to have a meeting sometime, Dan, and then pick back up on some of these things. But that's exciting. Is also exciting as we have a guest today for the very first time. We're welcoming to the program Dr. Timothy Squeers, who is pastor of Congregational Life at First United Reformed Church in Chino, California. He's graduate of Mid-America Reformed Seminary as well. Welcome to the program, Tim. It's really great to have you. Looking forward to talking with you today.
Well, thanks so much for having me, both of you. It's good to see you both again.
Yes, and how are things going out at First URC? Now, did I catch this correctly before we started recording that this is where you actually grew up?
I did. My father served as a minister in Chino for about 24 years, and all the way up to the point really that I finished seminary at Mid-America, and then he retired around 2017. And I was in the midst of finishing my PhD work at the time. And just a few years later, the associate position opened up and vacated. And I had for a couple of years prior been heavily considering a call to pastoral ministry. I was sort of weighing whether or not to go into full-time academics, teaching, or whether to go into full-time ministry. And perhaps interestingly, it was through the work that I did on my PhD that the Lord was really pushing me back towards pastoral ministry, not because I didn't enjoy the academic rigor, but I was just drawn to the joy of daily ministering to the saints and delivering God's word to them. So the Lord provided that opportunity to actually serve as a minister of the church I grew up in, which has some unique blessings as well as challenges. You know, people have known me since I was about 5.5 years old. And so a lot of them said to me right after I was called and ordained, they said, "I'm not going to call you Pastor Squeers. I'm going to call you Tim." And I said, "You know what? That's fine. I'm not going to make a deal out of it." But it's a wonderful group of saints here in Chino. It's a growing area. It's a diverse area. And so we are seeing some exciting growth here in the church as the Lord is drawing people from all tribes and nations and tongues. And they are coming longing for the gospel and longing for a solid biblical confessionally reformed church to belong to. In fact, we're seeing a lot of Calvinistic evangelical folks who belong to churches that are Calvinistic, maybe in terms of their doctrines of grace and their understanding of God's sovereignty over salvation, but are starting to realize, hey, there's something more to being Reformed than just having a Reformed or Reformed-esque soteriology. And they are really embracing covenant theology and infant baptism and so on and so forth. So it's been very exciting to see the growth here that the Lord has brought.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'm glad to hear it. I love those stories. I can't imagine in one regard, you know, what it would be like for me to go and pastor the church where I grew up. I'm sure that it would be wonderful, but there must be some interesting. It's got to be great to have that long history and to have that familiarity with the folks. Although, yeah, for some people, it might be a challenge.
What I find most of all, and this is a great blessing, is that I have an investment in this particular group of people.
Yes. Yeah.
That really drives me forward in my ministry. Yes, there are challenges. There are difficulties. And I have to be careful about, you know, not being too familiar with people. But overall, it's provided a real passion and a zeal for caring for the needs of this particular flock. And so I enjoy it immensely.
Amen. Well, I'm excited today to be speaking about this new book that Tim has written. It's a modification, if I'm not mistaken, of his PhD dissertation written at Fuller Seminary. It's titled Consciences and the Reformation, Scruples Over Oaths and Confessions in the Era of Calvin and His Contemporaries. It's published by Oxford University Press. Very serious title, a wonderful book. I've read all of it and I'm looking forward to talking about it and diving into the subject matter. I want to flip things over perhaps to Dan real quick, because this came on your radar first and then you passed it off to me and I was really excited to get a copy. But Dan, how were you introduced to this particular topic and this particular book?
Yeah, so introduced to it because I've known Tim for a number of years now. Mm-hmm. He was actually at Mid-America Reform Seminary when I was visiting to see if I was going to go back in like 2012. Mm-hmm. So I think the faculty had me meet up with Tim for lunch at some point, and I remember our conversation a bit. And so anyway, we've known each other over the years, and we both knew we were working on PhDs, and I knew Tim finished his up recently. Was it last year, Tim, or was it the year before?
2021, I finished.
Oh, so even earlier. So 3 years ago. And yeah, I think recently hearing of its publication with Oxford University Press, and then asking Tim for a copy of it, and then trying to get it on the program here, and I found the content useful. I mean, in a number of ways, as we're going to see in our conversation today. But originally, just hearing about oaths and confessional subscription and so on sounded like maybe a niche thing for pastors to can think about, but in reading the book, there's so much important implications and application for the way we think about conscience and even the Reformation, how significant conscience was for it. So I found this just eye-opening and very useful for doing pastoral ministry. And so you get a great blend of just pastoral implications, but also really solid, deep scholarship combined in a really unique way. So I thought we should definitely get this on the program.
Absolutely. I was really intrigued by this title and especially by the history. We're going to get into it a little bit later, but chapters 5 and 6 were really interesting and diving down into an era of Reformed history that I hadn't really considered, at least to this depth. I mean, early on, you're also dealing, Tim, with medieval legal backgrounds and principles and trying to understand what it means to take an oath. But some of this stuff on the surface to some people might sound really detailed and esoteric. But as Dan, you're alluding to, it certainly gets to the heart of things as we, particularly as ministers, but as all Christians are taking vows, membership vows or oaths, depending on how you parse those words, we have an obligation to understand what that means and how, you know, what we're actually saying and what we're bound to. Because we also hold to this freedom of the conscience, that we can't bind the conscience, and that gets into other things like the regulative principle of worship. There's a whole other side of things that we can talk about. But I'm really curious, Tim, if you might explain or just give us some of the background to your doctoral studies and not only heading off to Fuller and beginning your studies there, but how you eventually settled on this particular topic for your dissertation.
Certainly be happy to share some of that. When I was studying at Providence Christian College, getting my BA, I had some interest in doing a PhD and doing advanced studies after seminary. And while I was at Mid-America, a number of professors there encouraged me to consider doing some in-depth studies on Calvin and the Reformation, and in fact actually recommended Fuller because of a particular professor who was there, who's now emeritus, but John Thompson is a very, very fine Calvin scholar. Most of his work's been done in the area of history of exegesis during the Reformation, and is very well respected, and he actually filled the chair vacated by Richard Muller when he was at Fuller. I think probably in the late and mid to late 90s, he filled that vacated chair. And so I really wanted to study in that vein of scholarship. And got in touch with Dr. Thompson, and he was just an excellent scholar, but also very personable. And he was very excited to work with me on a topic that I was already thinking about, which dealt more with John Calvin's grasp of the third use of the law and how that was developed in his thought. At the time, that's what I thought I was going to be pursuing. And then I took a seminar under Dr. Thompson, which dealt with some of the challenging contexts and texts of the Reformation, particularly in Geneva. And I basically wrote what is in the book, Chapter 5, for that seminar. You guys know how this goes when you're in PhD studies. It's a very organic process. You start with the seed of an idea, and you say, maybe this can go somewhere. You hope that it really hope that it goes somewhere, and you can write a 300 to 350 page dissertation on it. But it ended up exposing me to some of the unique challenges that Calvin and Farel and others experienced in trying to consolidate reform in Geneva, namely that although Geneva was a city that had its residents swear an oath basically to the Reformation,
right?
Nevertheless, when Calvin and Farel wrote their Confession of Faith and requested the council have the residents subscribe to it and swear an oath to uphold it, they received all sorts of backlash and complaints and scruples over that demand, which eventually led to their expulsion in 1538. So I thought, are there more cases of this? Are there more examples of this sort of scrupulous complaint about the imposition or the requirement of extra scriptural confessions of faith, requiring people to subscribe to them as a means of creating unity and consolidating the Reformation? And in fact, I discovered there were, and that's where sort of the study took off. But that's how I came to the topic, really, by exploring a nexus of concerns that came together, concerns that had a rather tenuous relationship in the early decades of reform.
Mm. Yeah, I'd love if you could, let's start diving down into the main thesis of the book, and we can explore all sorts of other themes within it as well. But I'd love for you to expand upon, or at least introduce to the viewers and listeners today, the central thesis of your work and how you see the concept of conscience serving as a catalyst for reform in the 16th century.
Sure. Well, I think the primary thesis or the thrust of the book really is that Reformation era attempts at consolidating reform, at enforcing reform confessional standards, that effort was inextricably linked to the challenging task of both protecting lay consciences as well as elevating, even correcting those consciences. And so the book really isolates, like I said, a nexus of concerns, namely oath-taking, confessional subscription, the freedom of conscience, all issues that had, like I said, a somewhat contentious relationship in the early decades of reform. As you said, the concept of conscience played a significant role in the rising popularity of reform in the 16th century. In fact, the concept, even the word itself, freedom of conscience, rose to prominence in that century during the Reformation. It was very much a watchword of reform. In his early stance against Rome, Martin Luther, in his 95 Theses, as well as his conscientious stance at the Diet of Worms under Charles V, his early reformist efforts were really a loud call for freedom. And freedom for a number of things: freedom from the tyranny of the Pope, freedom from the monopoly of the clergy, you know, freedom from the strictures of canon law, freedom from a system of piety that misled people to think that they could find some sort of assurance outside of Christ and find it in a complicated system of human traditions and even false doctrines. And so really the Reformation was about a recovery of the gospel. It was a recovery of the primacy of the authority of God's word, which Luther and others said that alone can restore peace and freedom of conscience. And so if you think of Luther's stance at the Diet of Worms, it wasn't a statement, as some people think it was, of rabid individualism. Or self-confidence that he was right. In fact, it was something that Luther struggled with. Am I alone right? His confession, his conscientious stance there at Worms was a confession that God's word had priority over all things, over all teachings, and it was the only infallible source of knowledge that he and other sinners could be right with God, could be saved by God. So as we look at the Reformation, this concept of the freedom of conscience for Luther, for Calvin, for their other colleagues, mainly entailed a spiritual liberty from false teaching or false human traditions. But it did not mean freedom from any and all external compulsion or obligation upon the faithful, much less freedom from the rule of God's word. And so in concert with this insistence upon the spiritual freedom of the believer, the reformers, almost with one voice, argued that there were valuable biblical regulations and ceremonies and rites that the faithful needed to follow that were in keeping with the love of God and the love of neighbor. But it was for that particular understanding or interpretation of the freedom of conscience that they faced this pushback, these scrupulous complaints from nearly every sector of society, whether they were pastors or magistrates or certainly lay people. And that's why the book really reads like a series of vignettes, historical vignettes, a close reading of some of the texts and the controversies that surrounded Calvin's struggle to distinguish between what he thought were impious and harmful rules of the Catholic Church that burdened the conscience, to distinguish those from valuable, godly, biblical rules and regulations, observances such as oaths and formal subscription to confessions of faith. But again, it was that effort that really caused some tension and difficulty within centers of reform, which forced the reformers, Calvin in particular, to defend his tactics, which resulted in not a little anxiety for Calvin. He found himself, as I think the book illustrates, rather bothered by all of this at times. It seemed to him rather obvious that his instructions for the unity and the reform of the church were just plainly good for the people right. to accept, but they had a different idea. So certainly, as I try to illustrate, Calvin's pastoral patience, though not perfect in any respect, is on display throughout these episodes. He often had to accommodate even his own expectations for reform or his own desires for reform, even at times, you know, what he would have preferred to do in his own conscience for the sake of the greater good of reform in Geneva. So that gives you sort of an overview of the thesis and the purpose, the goal of the book as a whole.
I love it. I think it's tremendous. I'm wondering also if you might be able to expand further on what was going on in Geneva, but maybe even before that, just the nature of church-state relations at the time is also important to understand, because as Calvin and Farel certainly start to enact their reforms and then want to do certain things in Geneva, it gets them into trouble with the civil magistrate, so to speak. And really, in many ways, they're handcuffed from and prevented from engaging in proper church discipline because of various issues. We, as at least us here, Americans, have certain ideas about how the church relates to the state. And these are not necessarily, this is not what's going on in the Reformation. Setting the context there might be helpful before we get into some of the other issues regarding what Calvin and Farel were really urging the people to subscribe to, maybe setting some of the setting that context first might help people understand better the trouble they were getting or the issues that they were struggling with.
Yes. We typically use the word Christendom to refer to this period in time, this period in the time of the church, the early modern period or late medieval period, because of the fact that there was this overarching sense that that all sectors of society submitted directly to the rule of Christ through his word and spirit. There was not this sense of what we call in the Western world now, the separation of church and state in terms of authority or interest or jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. And so the concept of the civil rulers ruling on behalf of Christ in a specifically godly or biblical way to protect the preaching of the gospel and the successful operation of the church and its ministry was taken very seriously in a region like Geneva, which had, again, pledged itself to reform and to the Reformation and to the Reformed confessions. And so in Geneva, although Calvin advocated for something of a distinction of authority or distinction of roles between the consistory and the city council, in this particular way, he thought that the right of excommunication, the right to guard or fence the Lord's Supper, these were things that should be done by the consistory. This was his wish, this was his desire. And Calvin and Farel pushed very hard for that in the early years in Geneva, so much so that they were expelled for a few years as a result until they were asked back in the early 1540s.
And Calvin didn't want to go back.
Calvin did not want to go back. And I talk a little bit about that, I believe, at the beginning of chapter 6. Calvin himself was sort of vexed in his conscience as Pierre Verret was trying to convince him to return back to Geneva. Even the city magistrates were realizing that Calvin's presence there and his leadership was probably the best chance that Geneva had to get back on track after they had expelled them from the city. But Calvin really did not want to go back. He had had a wonderful several years in Strasbourg. And he came back with basically the same goals, but a different plan for implementing them, and that was partially in the creation of the consistory. But in terms of the authority that the consistory had, it wasn't really until the late 1550s, I think 1556, that the consistory finally even had the authority granted by the council to swear people in under oath, and then eventually finally to oversee the table and to decide cases of excommunication. But there was very much this sense that the consistory, even in exercising its spiritual oversight, was under the jurisdiction and authority of the city council. So different experience than we have certainly in the United States and in much of the Western world. But there was this overarching sense, as I said, that all aspects of life and society, both that of the institutional church and of society in general, were under the control of Christ. There was no separation of one's life, ordinary life or vocation from religion or from the Lordship of Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm. Just going back a little bit, you know, what I found so fascinating was a bit of the contrast between the Lutheran approach and what you find with Calvin and Farel in Geneva. Specifically when it came to the idea of dissimulation and whether or not somebody could be true in their conscience internally without that coming to external expression. And so that question kind of gets into the idea of, well, you know, the reformers acknowledge that there were vestiges of the true church still in the Roman Catholic Church. And so could somebody remain in the Roman Catholic Church, engage in all of its superstitions, while their conscience is not engaged in that? Like, are you able to have that kind of distinction in which, yeah, your conscience is fine, is against it, but you're still engaged in it? I'd be curious if you could just kind of highlight that difference between what you kind of find with the Lutherans, with Luther himself, and then also with Geneva.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in chapters 3 and 4, I deal specifically with this question of the Nicodemites or Nicodemism. The Nicodemites were so-called because they were basically closeted evangelicals or Protestants living in Catholic lands, where if they practiced their Protestant convictions and kept themselves from Catholic Mass in any sort of public way, they would be ostracized or even worse, killed for their commitments. And so these saints struggled with knowing what to do in their particular case. Should they stay and try to have some sort of impact, positive impact, transformative impact in their Catholic environment? Or should they flee entirely and remove themselves from their native land and seek refuge somewhere in a Protestant-friendly region? That was the struggle that they faced, not unlike the struggle of the first century Christians in some ways. I don't spend a lot of time really contrasting a Reformed versus Lutheran perspective on dissimulation, or simulation as it's also called, but I do distinguish the perspectives of several camps within the confessional reform at the time. So two camps really emerged from my research. There was Calvin and Farel and Vermigli and Viret, who took more of a, we might say, a hardline approach. And they said there is no confession of one's heart in believing the gospel without the confession of the mouth, right? The inward commitment of the heart requires a confession of the mouth in order for one's piety to be genuine, in order for one's conscience to be clean. And so they emphasize that such believers who find themselves in such a difficult situation need to make the hard choice, basically, and remove themselves from the realm of false religion and their families, and come to a place where they can exercise true religion, biblical religion, in a consistent, faithful way. Calvin's argument, and those of others, though Calvin, in this particular case, tended to be more frustrated with such individuals and less accommodating, less patient, whereas Viret comes to us as more of the pastor in dealing with these saints. Calvin deals with them as those who know what they ought to do, but are trying to put their consciences to sleep and not really deal with their responsibility. So they took a hard line approach as far as that goes. The other camp, really composed of Bucer and Capito, primarily Wolfgang Capito, were willing to deal a bit more patiently with such people in their circumstances. They were willing to allow that they could stay within Catholic lands and try to have sort of a clandestine influence upon their Catholic neighbors. That was the best way they could fulfill the rule of love, was by giving a winsome witness for the pure gospel. So the interesting thing is that while both of these camps properly understood the gospel, their application in terms of what it requires of us, in terms of our public piety, and what the consistent exercise of one's conscience looks like, they took a little bit of a different track there. Yet in the end, and I point this out in the book, Calvin later on, when he writes on this particular topic, and there's sort of an exchange between him and some of his other Reformed colleagues, he seems to suggest that there's no substantial difference in terms of the substance of what they believe between Calvin and Bucer and the others. So this is perhaps largely a matter of emphasis for them, but they did give somewhat different counsel to suffering Christians in Catholic lands.
Mm-hmm. When you don't want to get into maybe psychologizing all these reformers, but I believe alluded to in the book, or maybe it was some supporting books and resources I was reading in conjunction with it. the stereotypical view of Buetzer is that he was somewhat of like a get along guy, or like overly ironic, and maybe would prefer to not have confrontation. And maybe, and some people who are critics of that might say he was more willing to compromise his theological principles in order to have peace. But I as I recall, I think you were challenging that. And I'm wondering what your take on Buetzer was, and how you might compare and contrast him to, I don't know, someone like a fiery Pharrell.
Yes, that's a good way to describe Pharrell. Buetzer was more ironic, and was willing to affirm, perhaps even more so than Calvin, that there were vestiges of the true church even within Rome. Although he later on, I think, really his ironicism softened, namely his defense of orthodoxy hardened, and he realized that the Catholic Church was not going to be reformed in its present institutional existence, and so he would speak also of the church, the Roman Church, as holding to doctrines that were of the devil, of satanic. So his rhetoric about the Catholic Church could be very much like Calvin's. So I don't believe that Buetzer was a compromiser of orthodoxy.
Right.
Very good book by Brian Lugioio, written maybe 10, 15 years ago, on Buetzer's doctrine of justification. And I think he also makes that point, that although he has been sort of pigeonholed as a compromiser, as an ecumeniac, for lack of a better term, he was not soft on the biblical doctrine of justification, and he was not about to compromise with the Catholics on that doctrine. So his approach perhaps was more pastoral and soft than Pharrell or Calvin's, but I think his doctrinal commitments were quite sound.
Mm. Oh, that's good. You mentioned, we've talked about the consistory a bit. We'll talk more about that, but you mentioned the consistory's efforts to align parishioners' consciences with the Word of God. How did they go about that? Maybe with some more specifics, even theologically or philosophically, but how did they navigate the tension between ecclesiastical authority and individual conscience, especially in cases of doctrinal dispute or moral failure? You know, the church has an obligation to hold the truth and to require that of its members, and to hold them accountable. What was going on in terms of their understanding, and where did they draw the lines on certain things in terms of, you know, requiring people to certain actions, behaviors, professions versus allowing for more freedom?
Certainly. One of the things that distinguishes the Genevan consistory from the leadership in other Reformed centers, I think, was the clear evidence that suggested that the pastors and the elders of Geneva wanted to see the people of Geneva interiorize God's law. They still in Geneva, so many that had just recently come out of Catholicism really conceived of Christian piety as something that was limited to the external manifestations of piety, the complicated system of the demonstration of one's faith and faithfulness. And Calvin and his colleagues in Geneva really wanted there to be inculcated in each citizen or resident of Geneva a genuine affection for God, a genuine love for God that naturally issued into good works, not as works that were meritorious in any sense, but only as a demonstration of gratitude. And so the consistory really wanted to impress upon the Genevans the need for having sound consciences, to examine their consciences, to enter into their consciences. In fact, in chapter 6, I look at a number of cases where the consistory brings a transgressor before the body, and they're warned specifically, make sure you consult your conscience. You enter into your conscience before you swear an oath to speak the truth before the council or before the consistory. They really wanted people to have a sense of the importance of keeping a clear and sound conscience, not just before the magistrates, but before God himself. They wanted there to be an interiorization of God's call and his claim upon their lives. So that was something that was very very much impressed upon them. Another emphasis that they had was not merely upon what we might call the personal or individual conscience, but upon the communal conscience. In other words, the communal or public ramifications of the exercise of private conscience. I love a title of a treatise that Bucer wrote in 1523. It's one of those treatises that the title tells you exactly what the book is or what the main argument is. It's so long. You know?
Yeah, right.
Kind of like a
Puritan titles, yeah.
And the title of the treatise was One Should Not Live for Oneself Alone, but Also for Others and How to Go About It. And that was very much an important rule that governed the exercise of the consistory's authority over the people of Geneva. They wanted them to understand the importance of the rule of love or the rule of charity as it related to the people's submission to Christ through the authorities of the church, that the exercise of their own conscience should not be done merely for one's own sake, but for the sake of others in that society. And so that was certainly applied to oaths and confessions of faith as well. This was an argument also made in the Nicodemite controversy, that by not keeping a clear or sound conscience and compromising one's own confession in the midst of Catholic opposition, a person set a terrible example, a destructive example for their neighbors around them, for weaker consciences around them. So that was another concern that the consistory had very consistently, a concern for the ramifications of the exercise of one's personal conscience. But we also see, we talked about this a little bit already, but we also see an attempt to sort of gain, attempt by the consistory to gain somewhat of an upper hand in terms of the exercise of its authority against the what they can perceive to be the overreach of the city magistrates, the civil magistrates. Especially the last three chapters of the book deal with that, mm-hmm. I think. The ecclesiastics argued from their own conscience that their ministerial oaths required them to give the most direct spiritual oversight over the people of Geneva, again, which they thought the city magistrates took too much for themselves. And so those consistent appeals to conscience among the pastors of Geneva moved the church ever closer to a form of government that distinguished between the authority of the civil magistrates and the spiritual authority of the ministers and the elders, so much so that they would eventually, you know, take over oversight of the supper and excommunication. But there was definitely this sense that there needed to be an interiorization of the law of God, so that one would exercise their conscience only in a way that would benefit society as a whole and remove scandal from the community. We see that in some of the specific examples that I raise from the consistory records themselves, regarding marriage, regarding the misuse of the supper, and the treatment of the smaller members of society there in Geneva. So those are some of the concerns or tactics that the consistory used to promote a right ordering of a person's conscience, mm-hmm. among the people of Geneva.
I don't think you brought this out in your study, but I'm curious, you know, this idea of the individual conscience and yet its connectedness to other people, and it's not an isolated conscience. Was there any connection between that idea and covenant? Or do you think that might come out a little bit later? Because we think about covenant where there's individuals in relation to God, but then also as a covenant community. Yep. It seems like that would be a helpful category for keeping those things together in a kind of harmony.
I didn't see, but as far as my research took me, I did not see an explicit attempt to make that connection. I think it's undoubtedly implicit, though. The description of the Genevan community of Christians, as well as others in that area and at that time, there was an understanding that this was a covenant body of believers, that, again, as Bucer's title indicates, you don't simply live for yourself. You don't have merely individualistic or private concerns that drive your life or piety. You belong to a community, each one looking out for their neighbor, seeking their neighbor's needs above their own. And in that sense, there was certainly a covenantal understanding of the church that drove the reformers' efforts to promote a godly society and to restrain vice and scandal in the community. I did not do any work to see if there was an explicit connection or a covenant, specifically covenantal argument that undergirded that counsel that they gave to the Genevans. But it certainly, I think, was implicit.
Yeah. One other question, kind of going back to the authority of the consistory. We're both ministers in the URC, and our church order says that the consistory shall call the congregation together for corporate worship twice on each Lord's Day. I'm curious, how would Calvin interpret that the consistory's call to worship, and how might he, not to put, I know our churches, just to be frank, right, I will have some difficulty in terms of having more members at our first service than our second, typically, not always.
Well, that's not unique to you.
And OPC congregations as well. But I'm curious how Calvin at least would, like how would he handle that in terms of, what's the nature of that call from the consistory to worship?
He would have taken that call he did take that call very, very seriously. The consistory was necessarily invasive in its techniques of oversight over the spiritual lives and physical lives of the saints in Geneva. The consistory met far more frequently than our modern consistories meet, generally every Thursday. And it was a bit larger as well, because they had to deal with issues in all of the churches of Geneva. There was not just one church in Geneva, of course. There were a number of urban and churches that were way on the outskirts of town as well, more rural churches. And so the consistory met frequently and was very careful in its methods to discern whether people were being faithful in worship, whether they were being lax in their attendance at the Lord's Supper, whether their lives were, and even down to their speech and their business practices, were in keeping with the instructions and the moral commands of God's law. So, modern scholars will often look at the techniques of the Genevan consistory and say, well, these were oppressively invasive. And I think it's important for us to recognize that in the context of what they were doing, they were doing the best that they could to apply the responsibility that Christ had commanded them fulfill. They were exercising the authority and the spiritual care of Christ himself over these people. They took that job very seriously. From our modern perspective, it probably did look a bit invasive, but they would have called people out for their failure to attend worship. And they would have seen that as more of a violation of their promise to abide by the rules of the city, but also their promise to submit to the yoke of Christ. So they did call people out quite more than we do. I think in our own context, in our own situation, we have to interpret the church order, which is sometimes challenging to do, in a pastoral and a patient manner, encouraging people to come to a point where they desire to worship more regularly, more faithfully, and to submit to the rule of the elders and submit to their call to come and worship. When I say that, that the consistory was very diligent and very stringent in their rules and the implementation of those rules, I also want to note that they could be accommodating. All throughout the book, I point out instances where, much in keeping with the way canon law and civil law was used by the medieval jurists, Calvin and his colleagues could also be accommodating under certain circumstances, where circumstances were perhaps morally ambiguous or complex. They wanted to make sure that people, in line with that goal of interiorizing the law of God, they wanted to make sure that people had a genuine affection for God, that they weren't just obeying the laws of the city or the laws of the church for the sake of outward compliance. They wanted them to have a genuine piety and a heart and affection for God. And so in some circumstances, they could be a little bit more patient, a little bit more accommodating. But certainly in terms of enforcing the general expectations upon the populace, they were very devoted, very dedicated.
Mm. That raises an interesting question, or one that I kept thinking about as I was reading this book. And it's the question of what was required of citizens, at least in Geneva under Calvin's reforms. What was actually required of a citizen, not necessarily a church member? And again, these things they're connected in a way that they aren't today. But the issue here at hand is, you know, at the end of the day, you want people to interiorize the law of God. You want them to demonstrate a proper piety and to be spiritually transformed and exhibit that. But you can't make someone believe something truly,
right,
ex animo. So that raises all these interesting issues regarding what you can actually require of somebody. So what was specifically required in terms of a citizen's oath or whatever? And then how did that interact with, you know, the issue of belief?
Yeah, it's a very good question. It's an important question. It does complicate matters in this sense, first of all, that there were different types of residents that lived in Geneva. There were citizens, but that was a particular type of person. But not all people that resided in Geneva were citizens. Citizenship was obtained in a number of different ways. It could be obtained over time by living there long enough and purchasing one's citizenship. It could be something that was inherited if your parents were citizens. Wealthy people usually were put on the fast track to citizenship. And in that particular case, you might say the requirements and the level of oversight over them was a bit greater.
Sure.
So the citizen's oath was something that was for citizens alone. Nevertheless, if you were a willing resident of Geneva, you still had to abide by the civic and ecclesiastical regulations that were native to that particular city or region. And the expectation was, as whether a citizen or a resident, you abided by those regulations. You had your name on the rolls. You were known. You were your life was overseen and regulated by the jurisdiction of the spiritual and civic leaders. So very, very likely it was the citizens that had the spotlight upon them due to their more formal agreement to abide by the regulations of the city. But there was the expectation that everyone would as well. As in any larger society, there were issues that fell through the cracks. There's all sorts of examples in the consistory records of cases that were started and simply not finished for whatever reason. Consistory records are difficult to read. You know, thankfully, I had access to some French transcriptions of much of the unpublished consistory records that are just now gradually being transcribed into French from the handwritten notes, which are very difficult. I can't read them. You have to have a particular skill and set of studies to prepare yourself to read those types of things. And even then, some of it's in shorthand. Some of it's just simply incomplete. The one taking notes just had a bad day and was rushed and just didn't get everything down on the page. But there are a lot of cases of things just sort of falling through the cracks. And whether that was an instance of the case resolving itself before it actually met its end, or whether the seriousness of the case just did not rise to a level of seriousness that the consistory wanted to pursue. But there's still significant evidence that any resident, whether citizen or otherwise, of Geneva had a large or had a major expectation placed upon them to abide by the rules and standards of the city.
I'm curious to revisit the issue of Calvin leaving and going to, you know, being exiled, having to go to Strasbourg and then come back. Obviously, one of the critical moments in Calvin's life. But I'm most particularly interested to hear your thoughts on his return. He had to be compelled in some ways to come back. I loved reading his letters of how much he did not want to go. And it's almost like he was compelled twice to go to Geneva. He didn't want to go either time. Well, although I don't think he got the wine concession the second time around the way he did the first time from Pharrell. But most
that was a deal breaker.
Yeah. we'll do it. Okay, I'll come back again. I'm curious how his return, how his approach changed, if at all, specifically to church discipline and the use of oaths. How did that evolve? And what strategies, if that's a word we might use, did he employ to reinforce the role of conscience in the community's spiritual life? What was different the second time around?
Yeah, but you just first of all, you mentioned the threats that Calvin received the first time from Guillaume
from Pharrell. Mm-hmm.
To get him to commit to Geneva in 1536. Well, then when he left Geneva, Bucer threatened him with God's judgment, like upon a reluctant Jonah, if he failed to go to Strasbourg, like Jonah didn't want to go to Nineveh. And then, he was basically cajoled back to coming again. So, Calvin was in some ways the most moved man, in the sense of he really felt pricked in his conscience. He says, by the Spirit of God, through the demand of others that saw a particular gift and calling in his life to come and serve the church. But you're right that when he came back into Geneva in 1541, he wasn't really entirely the same person. He had learned a lot of lessons in Strasbourg. He had been a pastor to the refugees that had come to Strasbourg seeking asylum. He learned to be really, in many ways, to be a pastor, to be pastoral in his communication of the gospel, in his implementation of God's moral commandments, and probably getting married while he was in Strasbourg had some positive effect upon his demeanor and his character. And so when he finally agreed to return, it was on the basis of an undeniable conviction that he loved the people of Geneva. Even though they had caused him a great deal of anxiety and stress just in those 2 years he was there, and would give him more anxiety and stress in the years that followed, he nevertheless could not deny that he loved that people. He saw a great deal of potential for Geneva being a bastion of Reformed orthodoxy, a city on a hill, really. But when he came back, he realized that he couldn't come back with the same demands. And so he had the same goals, really, for the edification of the people of Geneva, for their spiritual oversight, for the correction of some of the old Catholic practices that really died hard among the people, some of that superstition that really remained there. But in the place of subscription oaths, really, the creation of the consistory was his tactic. And instead of just demanding this outright oath of personal obedience, the consistory would allow him and his fellow pastors and elders of the church to gauge the spiritual maturity and development of the people of Geneva. It would have, the consistory would, of course, have a disciplinary role to play. But it really wasn't primarily a disciplinary body, and for the large reason that it didn't have the authority to discipline or excommunicate. Again, not until about 1556 could it even put people under oath for testimony. So they would still make use of public gathering and hearings to refer people to the city council, where they would have sentence passed down upon them. But the consistory would give the initial assessment of the problem at hand and the sin at hand. Calvin did, of course, try to codify some of these plans in the Ecclesiastical Ordinances of 1541. That was one of the ways that the consistory and the council could agree on a set of standards for the people of the city to abide by. But it was sort of that two-track system of moral oversight that Calvin proposed. It was at least a working arrangement. It still had its problems. As I illustrate in the book, the pastors and the civil leaders butted heads frequently on issues that pertain to the authority of the ministers or the authority of the council, and to the point that this caused the vexing of consciences among the pastors who wanted to serve according to their oath of office. And they felt that even the council would not allow them to do that. And so there was a number of complaints there. But this was primarily how they dealt with the consciences of the people of Geneva, by the direct authority and exercise of that authority of the consistory, the people. My advisor, Dr. Thompson, referred to the consistory in one of his writings as a school for consciences, and it definitely was that. They it existed to train people to think in their consciences about their thoughts, about their actions, about their words, and to call them to submit themselves entirely to the rule of Christ through his office bearers.
Yeah. Tim, how did some of this play itself out? I know this isn't part of your work here, but I know you've done work on Calvin's preaching and the use of the law. But I'm curious what the effect of this was on Calvin's preaching in terms of even application and the conscience. You know, I think it's something that I know myself and a number of other pastors, probably every preacher wrestles with in terms of application and, you know, how specific should you be and in exhorting the congregation? Like, what are like, and so I'm curious if, you know, these discussions on conscience and the way it played itself out in Geneva had any noticeable impact on Calvin's preaching. I know it's a huge question, I'm sure, but if there's anything that stands out.
Yeah. Well, generally the answer would be yes. Calvin typically went into the pulpit with the exegetical findings that he had gleaned while writing his biblical commentaries. And then coming into the pulpit, speaking largely extemporaneously. I believe he would take the original languages into the pulpit with him, but he would speak largely extemporaneously based on his exegetical findings through his biblical theological work that he had done perhaps even that the week of. I mean, Calvin was constantly preaching, preached almost every single day of the week. It wasn't as if he just preached two sermons on Sunday and then he had the rest of the week to study. He was constantly writing, studying, teaching, preaching. But what we see in his sermons, and I encourage anybody to pick up some of his sermons, read his biblical commentaries on the text, and then read his sermons on the text. His sermons, which were transcribed, much of them were transcribed and are available and have been translated now as well. But they're rather, I guess you could say, circular in some ways. Calvin comes around several times to a reoccurring theme or applicatory word to try to drive home a particular point or application of the text. And it's not uncommon for him to use not only appeals to personal conscience, but also to appeal to people's understanding of God's obligations to them, to their neighbors. He appeals to some pedagogical techniques that sort of drive home some powerful rhetorical points. And so his preaching is definitely more effective in tone. He really wants to engage the heart. He wants to engage the mind and get people to feel the weight of their sin and guilt and to drive them to embrace Jesus Christ and his forgiveness, and then to live a life consistent with that faith that they profess. So I haven't done, I thank you for asking the question, because that could provide some fodder for a follow-up study, but to see what is the role of conscience in Calvin's preaching, that would be a good topic to address or explore. I don't do that in the book, so I can't answer with any great detail on that, but I do know that it was his general practice to be more applicatory in his more extemporaneous preaching, to really, really drive at the heart in the application of his biblical studies.
Hmm. Along those lines, you know, thinking about how many of these themes impact or influence or might instruct us today in the contemporary church, we're still dealing, we always deal with matters of the conscience and what we require of the people. And, you know, I'm working through Romans slowly as I have opportunity to preach. It's not every week, but as I'm doing various things. So I just worked through Romans 2, and speaking of the work of the law being written on the heart and the effect of the conscience upon all people who are made in the image of God, which is all people. But there's also this understanding that we have to recognize the effects of sin upon us, as each person has a conscience and it directs us. Even with the pagans, it either excuses or accuses them. But it's not a guide that isn't affected by what's going on with our darkened minds, our bent wills, so to speak. Yep. How did Calvin and the other reformers consider the effects of sin upon the conscience as well, recognizing that there's all sorts of twisted influences upon us, and someone might perceive that they have a matter of conscience, but then that doesn't comply with the testimony of God's word.
Right. Yeah, that's a very good question. And that's the reason that question is important is because it really gets at what the theological underpinnings of the reformer's conception of conscience was, and where did that come from? And that's why I take time in the first chapter to deal with Calvin's historical theoretical background as it relates to his understanding of law and conscience and obligations to obey church authority, and whether certain ceremonies to gauge belief and compliance to sound doctrine can be imposed upon people or not, those kinds of questions. And so if you go back and look at what the ancients and the medieval scholastics thought about the conscience, it really gives you at least some background to the issues that were already in place, were already being discussed before Calvin, Luther, and the others even come on the scene. They're very much indebted to the inheritance that they received, and much of their thought was built upon the teachings of the church fathers and the medieval scholastics. But if you go back and consider just generally how was the conscience regarded, what do people think about the conscience? The conscience was really considered to be the individual's innate knowledge of God's will. It was sometimes referred to as the tribunal of the soul, this knowledge of a judgment of reason that God rots or brings internally to the heart by the Spirit, or even by the law of nature, that judges someone's thoughts or actions as either good or bad. And the attempt of the early church and the medievals as well was to reflect what the Apostle Paul taught about these things. And you mentioned that he calls believers to a sound or clear conscience. He even refers to his own conscience as being clear before the Lord, and calls others to have a clear conscience as they, for example, submit to the governing authorities, not just for fear of God's wrath, but for one's own conscience. And as you said, Camden, he acknowledges that no one, not even the unbeliever, can have a seared conscience to the point that it ceases to function entirely. Even the unbeliever has an internal awareness of right and wrong. We mentioned Romans 2, the work of the law written on their hearts, their consciences bear witness, and their thoughts accuse or even excuse them. Based on Paul's teaching about the conscience in the New Testament, the medieval scholastics were really The first to develop what might be called a thoroughgoing theology of the conscience, and I deal with that in chapter one. I note there that there are basically two schools of thought on the conscience, especially in terms of relating the freedom of conscience to the external rule of the church, or the spiritual rule over the church, over the souls and the behaviors of the church. And the one school which Calvin aligned with due to his theological commitments was the Augustinian or Franciscan school. And the Augustinian understanding of the conscience particularly emphasized the effect of human depravity upon the conscience. And they acknowledge that the conscience is good, it's clear, as long as it submits to God's objective word. Not just that, but as that word is interpreted and enforced by ordained clerics, by those who exert spiritual authority in the church. And when it comes to the issue of whether the conscience binds a person to a particular action or commitment, they would say, well, the conscience only binds if it is exercised or applied in concert with, in agreement with, the word of God. And even in a secondary sense, when it is exercised in agreement with the counsel of wise clerics. And in fact, Augustine and others would say, if you're not sure whether this particular choice or action is of good conscience, then check with your pastor, check with your priest to see whether they would counsel you to do this, that, or another thing. So that was the Augustinian school. The other school basically borrowed some of the ideas of Abelard, but in particular, Thomas Aquinas was an advocate of this particular approach to the conscience. And that particular approach took a more, you might say, totalizing view of the conscience, that the internal intentions of a person was of utmost importance. And so Aquinas taught and believe that the conscience binds a person. Always, it always binds a person. Even if the conscience is in error, it still binds a person to a particular decision or case, because the conscience is really the only subjective tool or means by which any action is presented to a person as either right or wrong. And so he said, acting against your conscience is always wrong. It's always a sin. It always binds, even if you're mistaken. And so for Aquinas, when it came to the question of whether a person can in good conscience or in good faith disagree with the teaching of the church, Aquinas left that more open as a possibility, because of the way that he believed that the conscience was perhaps more sacrosanct, more sacred. But even then, in practice, he was really referring to things that are indifferent matters, in matters of indifference, not absolute strict rule. One should go with their conscience above all. But what's interesting about those two approaches, I think, and again, these are approaches to the conscience that had great influence upon Reformed thought about the conscience as well, is that both of those schools were trying to represent what Paul said about the conscience in the New Testament. Paul certainly taught that the conscience can be an error, that it needs to be corrected. When he talks about the depravity of the will needing to be transformed by the Spirit of God, he's dealing with the conscience really there. So Paul calls the conscience to be redeemed and transformed. But at the same time, you know, in certain passages where he's dealing with matters of Christian freedom, First Corinthians 8, 1 Corinthians 10, for example, he acknowledges that someone violates their conscience, their deeply held beliefs about something, even if it's matters of adiaphora or freedom, then there's a certain harm that is done, particularly to weaker consciences. So you see both of those traditions trying to grapple with what the Apostle Paul says. Well, those two schools of thought, the medieval tradition regarding the conscience, really shaped the perspective of the Reformers. That was their inherited thought world. And they were not innovative in many ways. They were reflecting what they thought was the best of their inherited theological tradition. particularly as it pertained to the governance of the church. And that's what we see. Calvin, for one thing, was generally Augustinian. He was Augustinian in many ways, theologically, but in terms of understanding the conscience as well, that the conscience was not infallible. It, like the entire person, was affected by sin and needed to be transformed by the Holy Spirit. And that led him to be both, and I make this point in the book, he was both a defender of the conscience, but also a critic of the conscience, of the consciences of the lay people under his charge.
Certainly.
He was a defender of the conscience in this way, that he regarded the conscience of a person as in theory at least, a reliable moral guide that would truly direct someone towards a particular action. Even in the unbeliever, Calvin says in Book Three of the Institutes, Chapter 19, I think, he says that the conscience is this spark of light that exists even among the dark, amidst the darkness that otherwise resides in the unbeliever's soul. But in the case of the believers in Geneva, he warned them about contravening their conscience. They were to examine their conscience before swearing an oath, so that they wouldn't swear to something that they could not keep. Again, we talked about the interiorization of God's law, a sense of the operation of the conscience. And he desired to protect the consciences of those under his care, even accommodating the situation so as to avoid a heartless application of the law. At the same time, he was a critic of the conscience. He and his colleagues had doubts and suspicions about the consciences of the people of Geneva. He frequently admonished their consciences and tried to correct their consciences that he believed were in error. And overall, I think Calvin and the Reformers indicated that they believed that there was a higher good than simply the maintenance of the individual conscience, that God's word, God's glory, the good of the community as a whole superseded in many cases the dictates of the individual conscience. As I said before, the highest concern was in some ways for the communal conscience, the ramifications of one's conscience and the application of it for the good of the whole society. So in that respect, Calvin was particular in talking about the need for the conscience to be transformed by the Holy Spirit so that it might function properly, so that it would not be in bondage to sin and corruption and a works righteousness mentality that was Luther's concern. But then the conscience also needed to be corrected and trained, which is why he, called people to adhere to the teaching of his catechism, which he wrote, I believe, in 1538, and why the creation of a consistory was so important and integral to that goal of correcting consciences and making them subservient to the will of God and ultimately to the will of the leaders of the church.
It's so significant that the theologian's doctrine of the image of God and the effects of the fall are going to have so many ramifications and implications afterwards, right? And so you're coming to Thomas Aquinas and his view of the conscience. It seems very much in line with his view of the image of God and the fall of man. Not affecting his nature in some sense, so the conscience remains intact. And so, from that starting point, I mean, you just constantly see so many implications in theology, but even in practice here and in the church. So that's not so much a question, it's just an observation that I think is really helpful. At least from Tim, not my observation, but
Sure.
from Tim's comments.
Appreciate
Of
that.
course.
I appreciate that. And earlier we were discussing the practical value of a discussion like this and or of a book like this, which might easily be overlooked by the armchair theologian or the ordinary reader in the church. And obviously it's an academic work necessarily. It's a monograph. It focuses on a very narrow slice of church history, a very narrow theological topic. But I'm very grateful that I've discovered since its publication, and even in the process of writing it, that there is a practical and a pastoral value to the matters that it discusses. And I've actually come across a number of situations in my ministry where some of the things that I've discovered through the research for this book, that has been very practical and helpful. I think one of the things that I hope people coming away after reading it come to realize is that there's a great value of confessions, and not just of having confessions, but the practice of confessional subscription, of formally binding yourself to the content of a confession for guiding the instruction, the discipline, the fidelity of the church. What I try to do in all the vignettes, the historical vignettes that I expose the reader to in this book, hopefully they come away with the idea that the church was strongest, it was most faithful, it was most effective at having a transformative effect upon the believer when it held to its confessions, but not just had a confession, but maintained useful practices for maintaining that confessional adherence. And that's what I try to especially highlight in the last chapter of the book when I deal with the Genevan Academy. Because as pressure to change the character of the school grew, as practical concerns interrupted the plans of the pastors and the professors who were involved in the instruction of the students, and gradually that the rules and regulations for maintaining the confession of the academy were lost, we find that the school never really recovered. And so, you know, confessional subscription, you know, pledging to submit your conscience to a biblical statement of faith, that remained historically, I think remains today, the most effective method for maintaining doctrinal faithfulness. And whenever it was abandoned, for whatever reason, even all sorts of expedient reasons, all sorts of problems arose in the church. Lax morals, loss of identity, breakdown of the church and the institutions that it supports. And I've seen that impulse, sadly, in some modern institutions, educational institutions in particular, that are really losing the grip, not just on their confessions, but on some practical, meaningful ways, effective ways, to maintain that confession among their faculty. Hmm. You know, we're seeing schools who are Calvinistic in their founding,
right,
either give up that confession altogether, or try to have their cake and eat it too, in this respect, that they want to remain Reformed in their vision and in their purpose, but have given up on trying to find people who have a Reformed confession to teach in their classrooms. And so what often is done is, you know, we're going to stay Reformed, but we're not going to require our faculty to sign on to these standards. Or we're going to have them sign on to the standards, but we're not going to actually require that they be members in a confessionally Reformed church. Hmm. And I've argued before, I said that puts before them the potential for a very harmful crisis of conscience. To ask somebody, to require somebody to say, yes, I sign on to these documents, and I link my conscience to them. I pledge that this is what I believe. But every Sunday I'm attending a church in good standing that teaches the exact opposite. Hmm. We're putting people in a position where they might potentially have a crisis of conscience, and we can't possibly maintain confessional standards unless we have a plan for properly gauging confessional commitment. And that was the story, really, of the Genevan Academy, that accommodation over time for the sake of viability undercut Calvin's founding vision for the school in a lot of ways, in terms of its educational goals, its spiritual character, so that, you know, by the late 18th century, the Genevan Academy, which was at one time a seminary training students to go into France and preach the gospel, many of them martyred for what they did, by the late 18th century, it had basically been reformulated under Napoleon as a secular institution, and then later as a large secular university by the end of the 19th century. So that the story, the sad story of the Geneva Academy is a story told too often of Reformed institutions. It's a lesson of history that a lot of Reformed schools and institutions and churches just have refused to learn. And if you don't have a good plan in place to maintain the standards of confessional orthodoxy, well, those confessions will soon be gone altogether. So I think there is a lot of practical value to a topic like this,
right,
where faithfulness, not just of the church as an institution, but of its individual members, as they seek to live in such a way that fulfills God's moral law, but as a way to witness as well in love and in charity to their neighbors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly this is a battle, something for which we must contend daily, and this striving is never complete until our Lord returns. And it's not just our parachurch organizations, institutions, educational places, governments, even in this history, but our churches. And we see this time and time again, this story that keeps repeating itself. I just was writing and finishing up an article on the Auburn Affirmation for our Reform Forum little newsletter magazine coming out. And that was a case in American Presbyterian history of people saying they subscribe to the confession, but then having all sorts of different interpretations and understandings about what that meant. And these things, as we continue to study even Reformation history and beyond and before that, these things are nothing new. Tim, this has really been a fun conversation. I really appreciate the book and the ample time that you've taken today to discuss this. I know they're going to find it interesting, and I appreciate especially the contemporary application. This is utterly helpful, and I think an excellent example where we see pastoral scholarship, where this is with Oxford University Press, a highly reputable press, very detailed scholarship where you're digging down even into, you know, the consistory, the French written consistory records from 500 years ago, yet at the same time connecting it to things we deal with and struggle with even in our contemporary churches. So well done, Tim. Thank you for talking about these things with us today. We appreciate it.
Well, it was a pleasure to have this conversation with you. Looking forward to continuing, hopefully, in the years to come. And thank you again for having me on the show.
Absolutely. It's our pleasure. Of course, everyone, get a copy of this book, Consciences and the Reformation, subtitled Scruples Over Oaths and Confessions in the Era of Calvin and His Contemporaries by Oxford University Press, published by them, written by our guest today, Timothy R. Squeers. That's spelled S-C-H-E-U-E-R-S. And you'll find that wherever scholarly and excellent books are sold. If you got any questions about this, certainly write in and we'll pass them on, or find us at community.reformedforum.org, where we have a nice little online forum, places to discuss. And of course, you can find information about everything we have going on, our other programs, our online courses, including our course with Dan Ragusa, one of our panelists today, and upcoming events at reformedforum.org. I do want to thank everybody for listening and for watching, and we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.